And the final case for hearing this morning is number 2014-1820, Johnston Coca-Cola Bottling Company versus Hamilton County Board of Revision. And in this case as well, the counsel for the property owner appellant has waived the argument. So we will hear argument on behalf of appellees. And the school board and the county, the school board want to go first.
Yes.
Mr. DiMuzio.
Thank you. I will focus this morning on propositions 1, 2, and 3, and Mr. Sheevy will focus on the others. Any questions, of course, we'll both be happy to answer. The main issue on proposition 1 is this concept of current use. And both Mr. Sheevy and I find this confusing as an argument because it's clear under Ohio law that highest and best use is the proper methodology by which real property should be valued. Given our market system, a capitalist system, most people have an incentive to maximize the use of their property. So everything else being equal, normally the current use is going to be the highest and best use. What's even interesting in this case and what confuses us is the appraiser for Ms. Bauernschmidt's client opined, and it's in our brief, he opined that the highest and best use is the current industrial use of the property. So I don't understand how you can spin these arguments that, oh, gee, Mr. Thorson, who's the expert for Mr. Sheevy, Mr. Thorson somehow used current use when that current use is the highest and best use, and their expert agrees it's the highest and best use. So,
well, doesn't that potentially have two different meanings, though? The current use being the highest and best use could mean the general sort of industrial use of property as it might be used by different owners, as opposed to the situation of the special purpose doctrine where the property is specially adapted to a particular owner.
Could be.
And how does that relate to this? Is this a special purpose case?
No, I was going to say, that's a good argument if this were special purpose, but it's not. This is an industrial property, happens to be used as a bottling plant, but it has that particular use. To me, for example, the argument they're using is they're saying, look, if you have an office building and you have an apartment building, and the apartment building is being valued, and some expert uses the office building as a comp, mm-hmm. and the BTA says, wait a minute, we prefer the other expert because they used apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. They're going to say, wait a minute, you can't talk about the use as an apartment building. That's a current use, and that's terrible. Well, obviously, you have to be able to have some concept of comparability. So that's, to us, the fact it's a bottling plant or we could find other bottling plants is an issue of comparability. It's a factual issue. It's not an issue that disqualifies something from being used at all. It is something that goes to the weight of the evidence, and I think it's a good point. If this were a post office or some other, special use that might not have a commercial use, then I think they would have a good argument that you got to be careful on that. Although somebody could opine that the highest and best use is as a government building, and then at that point you have to deal with it. But you're right. I think their argument is that if you're looking at some subset of a use, isn't that a current use? And I'm saying as long as that current use is the highest and best use. And what's interesting, again, when you look at the quote that we have in our brief from the supplement, I think it was supplement 37. I think I'm quoting the right words properly. It says, continued industrial utilization that is currently in existence. That's the term their expert uses. So I don't know how you can be more specific that the current use is the highest and best use when their own expert does that. So that was really the feeling on that one. The second proposition deals with this use of sale leaseback and leases. And again, it's a confusing argument because I was not able, I looked carefully, I was not able to locate any evidence in the record that specific leases or specific sales used by Mr. Thorson were above market leases. Their arguments only make sense if somehow bad information got into the system. Somehow Mr. Thorson was unfair in his utilization of these comps or these leases. But in fact, it's all speculation and innuendo. If you go back and read the record, they said to him, well, did you check this? Did you make sure, you know? Well, of course, many of these, as Mr. Sheevil mentioned, are in fact confidential. It's very hard to get, you know, a landlord's, you know, specific documents buried in their vault somewhere. But even if you could, that's their job. They had Mr. Thorson's report before the hearing. They had it in accordance with BTA rules. They should have put their expert on rebuttal. You know, he's allowed to testify about these things. He can testify about hearsay. And the expert could have come on and said, Mr. Thorson's analysis is wrong, and here's why. This lease is above market. This was a sale leaseback at a market rent that is a bad market rent. Sale leasebacks by themselves aren't bad. They're only bad if games have been played with the purchase price versus the rent such that it makes the sale price not usable. But it's all speculation. It's all innuendo on their part. They should have, if their argument's a good one, it should have been easy for them to come in and point out. Instead, they want the trier of fact to say, whoa, Mr. Thorson must be hiding something. They want to shift a burden onto Mr. Thorson to, in essence, you know, cross-examine himself. And that's ridiculous. That's their job. It's not Mr. Sheevy's job or my job to tell them why our expert has bad facts. That's their job. And with the discovery process, that's something that they could have done and could have done easily. On the third issue, again, we view the third one as very similar to the first one. Again, as long as this current use is the highest and best use and it's not in dispute, then I think it's fine. And we just don't see the issue in that one. Okay. That's all I had.
Thank you, Mr. DeMuzio. Mr. Sheevy.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to touch on Mr. DeMuzio's points, this is, to me, a strange case where the appellant's main criticisms of our appraiser are equally true of her appraiser. You know, she says our highest and best use is wrong. It's the same as his highest and best use. She says we use lease fees. Her appraiser says lease fee is fine as long as they're at market. Our appraiser says all the leases he looked at, he confirmed them with the brokers, with published reports, that they in fact were market. So there's no indication that they were anything other than market. She criticizes our appraiser because he didn't personally talk to the buyer or the seller. Her appraiser didn't talk to anybody either. He relied on brokers' brochures. He relied on CoStar. That's what our guy did. He relied on brokers, CoStar. One person he said he knew for 14 years. Knew that person. She would have you believe that he didn't verify anything. She would have you believe that he used only lease fees and sale leasebacks. Well, there are no sales leasebacks in the record. There's only one comparable sale that once was a sale leaseback, but then sold later. That's the sale Mr. Thorson used. He didn't use a sale leaseback. But her brief would have you believe that all of his comparables were sale leasebacks or lease fees. None of that's even true. Now, to the other two arguments that Mr. Thorson was biased.
If there's a sale leaseback and then there's a subsequent sale of the property that's still subject to that lease, there could still be a higher sale price on account of elevated rent from the sale leaseback, right?
That's possible, but it's
but you're saying that's not the situation.
Yeah, the subsequent sale is by definition not a sale leaseback.
That's true.
And she would have you believe that he relied on all these sale leasebacks, which he didn't. And then to her fourth assignment, I think it's her fourth assignment of error, that Mr. Thorson was biased because he was a county employee. As I said, we've been doing this dance for about over 30 years now, where every time our appraiser testifies, she asks, are you employed by the auditor, therefore you must be terrible, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I didn't do quite as much here as I generally do, but in rebutting that, but she never objected to his testimony. She made mention of the fact that he worked for the county auditor, and then in cross-examination, or he said his salary is the same whether he wins or loses. He has no incentive to come up here. It's no fun for an appraiser to go to the Board of Tax Appeals and get beat up for a couple hours by Ms. Bauerschmidt or somebody else. I mean, we have, I think, in this triennial, we had, I think, 7,000 cases at the Board of Revision, which compared to Cleveland is fairly small. But of that 7,000, we get about 5% of those to go to the Board of Tax Appeals. And I'd say only a handful of those ever get tried. And very seldom do we ever come here. So that fact alone belies her argument that somehow our appraisers are out there and we're trying to get the highest value, and everybody that comes in, we're trying to fight them off. And the fact is, the Board of Revision, the vast majority of cases, people get either get reductions or they're satisfied with the result. So our appraiser has no incentive to come to Columbus to, you know, to write an appraisal, to come up here and get cross-examined when he could be at home with his family or sitting at his desk. And there's no evidence in the record that he's in any way biased. She says that, well, he's biased because he has something to do with the original appraisal. And that's belied by the record as well. He said he didn't have anything to do with the 2011 valuation.
Was he employed, does Hamilton County employ a company or
they do.
Firm?
They do. The record.
And is this Mr. Thorson employed by that firm?
No. The Hamilton County, I think unlike other counties, they have a staff of appraisers.
In the auditor's office.
In the auditor's office. Okay. In addition to that, on the triennial and sectional updates, they hire a firm.
Okay.
And the record here reflects that they hired what's called Lexor, L-E-X-U-R. And Mr. Thorson says the only involvement he had with his plant was he would pick up new additions, new constructions periodically. And he said for 2011, he had absolutely nothing to do with the valuation for 2011. He said our firm, Lexor, an independent firm, they're the ones that came up with the valuation.
Okay.
So he had nothing to do with it. He had nothing to gain by this appraisal. And there's no evidence in the record that reflects in any way he's biased. And I think the argument is basically waived because she never objected to his testimony. But even assuming he was biased in some point, the Witt case says the court is free to look into that bias and take it into account. Well, she never really raised the issue. And it's only here for the first time that she says that the court should disregard, I think her argument is the court should disregard his testimony.
I mean, her theory is this is not an independent
right.
expert.
Right, but in fact, he's a state-certified appraiser, and he renders an independent opinion of value. No one the auditor doesn't say, hey, Doug, come up with a high value because we really need to get a high value. That doesn't happen. It's never happened. No one's even suggested. She doesn't even suggest that. She simply suggests that because he works for the auditor, he's biased. And as I said in my brief, it could be equally true that Mr. Rasek, because he's employed by Ms. Bauerschmidt, is biased. Because he has more to gain, because if he wins a case, she's more likely to hire him the next time. If he comes in and loses every case, she's not going to hire him anymore. So the incentive to be biased is much greater in her appraiser than ours. Our appraiser's life would be much easier if he just said, yeah, that's right, I don't want to go up there. So to me, it's an argument she's, as I said, she's made for over 30 years. The Board of Tax Appeals has never accepted. I don't think this court should accept that argument either. The last assignment of error, she talks about the nunk-pro-tunk order. The Board of Tax Appeals issued an order. It said, we're considering tax year 2011, talks about the appraisers. And then in the last sentence, it says, we therefore find the value for 2012 is as follows. Well, the last sentence is a typographical error. Obviously, it was 2011. They said it in the first sentence of their opinion. All the record reflects 2011. So we raised it by motion in a timely fashion with the board that they had made a typographical error. They corrected it. They nunk-pro-tunk the order and said it should be 2011. Ms. Bauerschmidt says, well, the board had no authority to issue that order because I'm not really sure I even follow her argument, but if they can't issue that order, then, as I say, apparently she's stuck with the original order, which you know, that's so she either puts aside the first order, puts aside the second order, but it's clear it's simply a typographical error. Happens all the time.
Was the nunc pro tunc issued within the appeal period?
Yes, the original order was September 25th. The nunc-pro-tunc order was October 22nd, so less than 30 days.
Okay.
And then she filed an amended notice of appeal. That's why there's two.
Right.
She filed a notice of appeal from the first order and an amended notice of appeal from the second order. So I think that's all I have.
Okay.
Thank you,
Mr. Sheeby. This, I'm sorry, the argument's concluded. This case will be submitted, and the court will advise the parties of its decision.